Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. Hey, before we get into more discussion on Ukraine, just a quick word about the now infamous Oscar slap, wherein actor Will Smith physically slapped comedian Chris Rock in response to a tasteless joke Rock made in reference to Smith's wife, Jada Pinkett Smith's hair. There aren't too many people I've heard from who would try to justify Smith's assault on Chris Rock, nor many who feel that Chris Rock's joke was not out of line. But while most folks object merely to Smith's outburst because it was violent, only a minority seem to recognize that by acting in defense of Jada, Will Smith preempted her agency in the matter. In essence, he did not allow her an opportunity to speak for herself, and so in that way he effectively compounded any injury caused by Rock's debasing put-down. There are some, mainly a small number of black women, who found Smith's gallantry refreshing, but there's a much greater percentage who worry that in striking Rock, Smith reinforced damaging stereotypes about black male temper and violence. Indeed, Smith seemed to acknowledge that in his formal written public apology. I find it refreshing that the public discourse over this incident has been so analytical and wide-ranging. I get the sense that public awareness of the underlying issues is slowly deepening. All the same, however, environmental activists point out that it's over 60 degrees in the Antarctic right now, and a major ice shelf has now permanently disappeared, or that we still haven't taken adequate steps to reduce fossil fuel consumption. Still, others point out that Israel is still occupying Palestine and bulldozing homes and orchards on the West Bank, Saudi Arabia is still decimating Yemen, and Russia is still attacking Ukraine. You know, just to illustrate the scale of importance of these various events in relation to each other. Well, speaking of Ukraine, we have another panel in today's show, this one convened by Senator Bernie Sanders. His own views on the Russian invasion are somewhat narrowly focused on the injustice of it and its impacts on the global politics and climate change. Some of the panelists allude to the hypocrisy of America calling for justice in Ukraine while actively supporting injustice elsewhere around the globe. No one really digs into the U.S. involvement of the 2014 coup in Ukraine or the Western hegemony vis-a-vis pushing NATO's boundaries, but we've covered that extensively over the last several weeks, and I see the job here as providing as well-rounded a perspective as possible. So we'll let these panelists have their say, and we'll call it food for thought. The panelists include Jewish Currents Editor-at-Large and City University of New York Journalism Professor Peter Beinart, and former White House staffer Ben Rhodes, and then Georgia State University professor Maria Repnikova, a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Institute for, International Center for Scholars.
So with that now, let me introduce our panel, and it's a great panel. Congresswoman Barbara Lee represents California's 13th Congressional District and serves as the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus Peace and Security Task Force. And Barbara and I are old friends from when we were in the House, when I was in the House with her. Ben Rhodes is a writer, political commentator, and a senior advisor to former President Barack Obama. He is currently a contributor for NBC News and MSNBC, co-host of Pod Save the World, and author of several books, most recently After the Fall. Peter Beinart is a professor at the Neumark Graduate School of Journalism at City University of New York. He is editor-at-large for Jewish Currents, a CNN political commentator, a fellow at the Foundation for Middle East Peace, and the author of several books. Dr. Maria Repnikova is an expert in Chinese political communication and in China-Russia relations, and an author of two books on Chinese media and soft power. She's an assistant professor in global communication at Georgia State University. So thank you all very much for being with us. Barbara, why don't you take it away?
Sure. Thank you very much, Senator Sanders. And I want to thank you for calling us together this evening. You know, the bloodshed and the war that's taking place in Ukraine has us all heartbroken, first of all, and glued to the television and asking what more can we do? And so it's good to take a moment to try to do a deep dive about how we got there, the historical context, and what this means just in terms of geopolitical moments where we're in and what this means for the future. So thanks so much, Bernie, for this. A couple of things I just like to say beginning my comments. First, I am I chair the Appropriations Subcommittee on State and Foreign Operations. It's the subcommittee that provides, for the most part, all of our non-defense funding, diplomacy, development, humanitarian assistance, embassy security, all of the non-defense related efforts that we take place, that take place around the world from our government. I chair that subcommittee. And of course, the three stools we still talk about in terms of our national security strategies are diplomacy, development, and defense. And you all know me. I've been trying for years to reduce the defense budget so we can put more of our tax dollars into development and diplomacy and preventing wars. And so that's where how my frame of reference and my views on national security fall. And again, seeing what's taking place, you know, and I'm reminded of the song, War is Not the Answer. I mean, it's so relevant today because we see what's taking place as a result of Putin's slaughter and beginning and invading Ukraine and really fomenting a very dangerous war that could lead, if we don't de-escalate, and I hope that everyone understands that our role is to push hard and not do anything that would escalate this bloodshed, but what do we need to do to de-escalate? And so it's very important, though, that we also understand, I was at the Munich Security Conference a few weeks ago, that the world is very unified, and I have to acknowledge the Biden administration for his leadership and the administration's leadership on holding the line on a lot of what could take place in terms of the insertion of our troops, in terms of putting us in harm's way, in terms of beginning of putting the United States in the context of having to be in a war with Russia. And so at the Munich Security Conference, everyone was acknowledging this administration's leadership and holding the line on that while trying to figure out ways to support the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian government, quite frankly. And so the European allies with the United States, we have a lot to do if we're going to protect our democracy. We have to figure this out and figure it out in a way that's not going to lead to more bloodshed. A couple of things I just want to mention in terms of what's taking place in the overall context of what Putin's move is. And that's not just about Ukraine. It's about actually moving toward trying to establish autocracies, trying to demolish and let the world, make the world believe that autocracies are a better form of government. And so I see him as trying to dismantle and send a signal to Europe and yes, to the United States that democracies are not the future of the world. And when we look at what has taken place in our own country, and I try to make the point, the other day I was talking to Ambassador McCall and saying, you know, do your students see the connection between, for example, misinformation, disinformation, voter nullification, voter suppression? Do you understand and do they see the context in which the United States is vulnerable now? January 6th, when you look at the connections between what's taking place with Putin and what is taking place in our country, it's very clear to me that there's some clear links and clear ties. Several years I was in Germany, same time Steve Bannon was in Germany organizing. And so we can't see this just as a Ukrainian issue. This is really an attack on democracy, and no country, no democracy is exempt, including the United States of America. And that's why I think it's so important that we talk about this. And I think if there's any positive in this, which we know there are no positives out of it, but the American people are beginning to see and understand the nuclear war is still an option that Putin is talking about. And as we talk about nuclear war, which is annihilation, really, of the planet, we have the Iran nuclear deal that we're attempting to go back into and negotiate. And so I think now is being reminded of how small this world is and what affects one, what affects the people of Ukraine and Ukrainian people affects us in the United States. And there's no way we can say, oh, we're only concerned about domestic priorities and domestic policies. We have to be globalists, and we have to understand the context now in which this war is being waged. Finally, I'll just say, yes, I'm not an expert on the region, but I've been in that neighborhood a couple of times. I've been to Poland, Lithuania, Georgia, Armenia, Moldova, and Ukraine. And one thing I came away with was that people in Eastern Europe, they pride themselves on democracy. And I think the rest of the world is seeing how strong and how focused and how deliberate and how committed they are to maintaining a democratic country. And we have to be cognizant of that and do everything we can do in our own country to be as vigilant and as determined to protect our democracy, which means we have elections coming up. We see voter nullification, voter suppression, can't get a Voting Rights Act passed. This is all connected to the erosion of the democracy that we know so well in this country. And so thank you again, Bernie, for inviting me to be part of this panel, because it's so important to educate everyone aside from watching the trauma and the death and the bloodshed and the destruction. And we'll talk later about what we're doing to help the refugees and the economic issues that we're trying to help with the Ukrainian government and all of those. But I just wanted to kind of put my perspective in context about how this is a threat to one is a threat to all.
And you're absolutely right. Barbara, thank you very much. Now we're going to hear from Ben Rhodes. Ben?
Sure. No, thanks for doing this. I'll just say a few words about the democracy aspect. And I think it's important for us to understand that, you know, Putin has basically been at the vanguard of the resurgence of ethno-nationalism and ethno-nationalist authoritarianism in the 21st century. And I think as all of our backgrounds, all of us who are on this panel would speak to, tragically, ethno-nationalist authoritarianism leads inexorably to conflict. And that's what we're seeing again. We're seeing the return of that brand of history. I want to speak about the ways in which Putin has exploited the vulnerabilities in democracies behind his authoritarian project and why Ukraine became the center of that. And so I'm going to move through some stuff pretty quickly here. But you're talking about somebody who comes to power on the basis of a politics of a sense of national humiliation and grievance, not just around the fall of the Soviet Union, but around a sense that the 90s and the vast privatization of Russian state resources was totally corrupt, totally screwed ordinary Russians, and therefore they turned to this kind of gray KGB man to restore a sense of stability. But then what Putin did, is kind of find the vulnerabilities in globalization to gain a foothold for his brand of politics. So what do I mean by that? Number one, kleptocracy. So he sees, well, what I can do is I can have my own oligarchs who are able to get their hands on vast amounts of natural resources that were once part of the Russian state or Soviet republics. And we're basically going to use the openness and unregulated nature of the international financial system to kind of launder and repurpose that money in all manner of ways. So we're going to get these companies that are basically resource grabs listed on stock exchanges in places like London. And then we're going to create whole networks of shell companies, pieces of paper with different names on it that all trace back to Putin's cronies, his oligarchs, the people who are financing his politics. And that money is invisible. That money is beyond reach. And he's creating a billionaire class that in turn invests in his politics. And that's what allowed him to consolidate power. And so taking massive, cynical advantage of our open systems and unregulated systems to build kleptocracy that was then mimicked by other leaders like a Viktor Orban in Hungary. When you look at national security, Putin has been deft at times and just lucky at others at both responding to and taking advantage of some of the framework of national security. So the war on terror was the framework under which Putin himself started to say, well, I'm in a war on terror against Chechens here in Russia. That's going to be a basis upon which I'm going to start to restrict civil society. I'm going to start getting rid of the direct election of certain officials so that they be appointed by the Kremlin. It doesn't mean it's our fault. It means that we have to understand the ways in which leaders can kind of repurpose a framework for their own purpose, while at the same time, you know, using a degree of whataboutism for a post 9/11 American foreign policy to justify his own aggression at times. And NATO is a piece of this. You know, he has a symbiotic relationship with NATO because on the one hand is reacting against, and I think a genuine way, a sense of NATO encroachment on Russia's space. But on the other hand, he depended upon the sense of grievance that came from NATO enlargement to fuel his politics too. So he was kind of symbiotic with some aspects of what we were doing. And then lastly, disinformation, where essentially he's realizing in one big information pool, if I'm fueling conspiracy theory, if I'm fueling ethno-nationalist, racialized grievances. If I'm fueling, I don't need to, and Alexei Navalny said this to me, Putin doesn't have to convince you that he's right or telling the truth. He has to convince you that everybody's lying. Everybody's just spinning a narrative. So therefore, his extreme narrative about the Ukrainians being Nazis, et cetera, is just one more narrative out there that is competing. He saw the open space of our technology and social media platforms as a vehicle for him to do this. I think the reason it's important to understand Ukraine is not just that this is an effort to reconstitute, not necessarily the Soviet Union, because he's not as focused on Kyrgyzstan as Ukraine, but really the Russian Empire. He has a blood and soil nationalist ideology around Russian speakers and quote unquote ethnic Russians that allows him to claim lots of chunks of land. And Ukraine is the biggest one. But also we have to understand that the reason Ukraine has been pushing and pulling back and forth, the reason there were popular revolutions in Ukraine in 2005 and then in 2013 was as much because of corruption as democracy. The Ukrainian people's absolute frustration and disgust with the Russian version of kleptocracy that was being imposed upon them. So I think progressives have a lot of answers to bring to the table here, not just in the immediate crisis of Ukraine, but in terms of how do we insulate democracies in our societies against kleptocracy, against disinformation, against the kind of cynical manipulation of national security for aggression. And so this is why this conversation is so important, because we should not shy away from those debates. Often hawks put themselves forward as the champions of democracy. But frankly, the blind spots in a lot of the systems that have been designed by more right-wing elements are precisely the things that Putin had been taking advantage of for so many years before he committed this, I think, world historical blunder of overreach in Ukraine.
Ben, thanks very much. Peter Beinart. Peter?
Thank you. So I think I would just start with a set of principles. It seems to me the principles that should animate progressive foreign policy are opposition to imperialism, opposition to aggression, opposition to exploitation, and opposition to the denial of human rights. And what makes progressives different than most hawks, I would say, is that we're willing to fight against those things when the United States does them. In fact, that we see our foremost responsibility as fighting against them when America does them, because we bear the most responsibility for what the US does. But I think sometimes some folks on the left make the mistake of forgetting that those evils are not unique to the United States. They're tragically human evils that every powerful nation commits. And so if you are opposed to, as you, Bernie, have eloquently talked about America's immoral interventions in Chile and Guatemala, you have to also be opposed to Putin's immoral intervention in Ukraine. It's not inconsistent. It's precisely consistent. The point is, we are opposed to these principles, whoever violates them. And if you can only see America as the bad actor, that's a kind of weird form of inverted exceptionalism. It's the kind of the flip side of the people who think America can do no wrong. If you think America is the source of all the problems in the world is just a lot more complicated than that. And so it's important to, I think, distinguish the fact that you can recognize that there are very valid debates and criticisms of America's post-Cold War policy towards Russia. There are a lot of things that I think we got wrong. Ben was mentioning one of them. One of them is that we were complicit in this privatization policy that in the name of, I think, a kind of very neoliberal economic policy led to the corruption and massive inequality that helped Putin to sustain power. I also think that although the expansion of NATO was probably good for small countries in Eastern Europe, it left Russians, not just Putin, but even much more liberal Russians, feeling betrayed after they had given up their Warsaw Pact alliance. And certainly the decision in 2008 to offer Ukraine membership in NATO, when there was really no prospect that Ukraine was ever going to get into NATO, was the kind of worst of all worlds, because it aggravated the Russians tremendously, but didn't actually provide the Ukrainians any actual security. So those debates are really important, and it's really important that people who raise those questions don't get dismissed as Putin apologists and traitors. You see that a lot that happens during American wartime. Those are really important debates. It's also really important to recognize, however, that no matter what mistakes you think the United States made strategically in the post-Cold War period, none of that remotely justifies Putin's criminal aggression against Ukraine. It's a crude analogy, but you can think about it this way. There are a lot of things, starting with the Treaty of Versailles, that the Western powers did wrong after World War I. None of them justified Germany's, the Nazi invasion of Poland in 1939. And I think it's really important to be able to have both of those conversations separately. Now we're in a situation where I think what progressives need to emphasize is, in my view, it's right for us to support the Ukrainians militarily, and it's right for us to sanction Russia, because we have a moral obligation to try to make sure Ukraine survives. We have a moral obligation to oppose what is Russian imperialism. When Putin says that Ukraine's not a real nation, so he's going to control it, that is imperialism. But we also need to recognize, and this is what Hawks will not, is that sending weapons and imposing sanctions on a population that drives them into poverty, these are evils. They may be necessary evils at this particular moment. I would argue they are necessary evils at this particular moment, but they have huge negative consequences, which is why, in my view, it's important that we say that we envision a moment when these sanctions against ordinary Russians end. Maybe not against Putin and his clique of oligarchs, but against ordinary sanctions. We have an addiction to sanctions. We should not want these things to last, go on and on and on, so we can try to weaken Russia in a Cold War. When we should say that when there is a peace agreement, and that's our goal, a peace agreement, we lift the sanctions on ordinary Russians, and we then stop flooding that place with weapons, because there are long-term, very dangerous consequences of this. Just to give one example, the sanctions against Russians don't only immiserate a lot of Russians, they're contributing to this global food crisis, because the war plus the sanctions mean that both Russia and Ukraine, which are big sources of wheat and other foodstuffs for poor countries in Africa and the Middle East, are not being able to export those things. So I think that the challenge here is, we should be supporting Ukrainians and trying to weaken the Russians, because we want the best possible peace agreement for Ukraine, the one that leaves Ukraine in as much control of its territory as possible and allows it to rebuild and hopefully move towards joining the democratic West. But we don't want this war to be used to create a permanent Cold War that will have very dangerous and unintended consequences down the road.
Peter, thanks very much. Maria Repnikova.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. So I'll make a couple of points. One on Russia, and just following up on Peter's comment about sanctions. The sanctions that, you know, have been imposed on Russia, they've been manipulated by the Russian propaganda machine to convey this message that there is really a war waged against Russian people, Russian ordinary people. And this war is an economic war, and that Russia will survive. It will persevere. It will come out as a victor. But there's a lot of mobilization of public opinion on Russian media that aims at this message that, you know, there is a real economic warfare aimed at ordinary Russian people. So that's just something I wanted to put out there. But moving towards the point about autocracy and Russia evolving into maybe a different political system, or at least a more extreme version of autocracy, I wanted to emphasize that although in the past, I would say 10, 20 years, a lot of commentaries would link Russia and China together, or put them in the same bracket in terms of media freedoms, or, you know, the degree of autocracy, Russian civil society space and media space has been more open than that of China until pretty much the past 4 weeks. So we've seen very brave investigative journalism, civil society activism, and even opposition protests. We're probably not going to see that again for a very long time. We see a severe crackdown on independent voices, and many talented Russians are afraid to go back to their country and teach at local universities and be public speakers and leaders and civic society activists. It's a really big shift. So I just wanted to point that out, because that creates quite a degree of challenge of engaging with Russia, not just now, but really in the long-term future. What is this going to look like? What kind of society is it going to be when the main opposition leader is jailed for 9 years, Navalny, right? And nobody else is really up there to compete with Putin or anybody else from his clique who might be appointed to power if Putin were to one day disappear. So that's just something to note here. But the other point I wanted to make is about China. You know, you asked about China and what the role China is playing in this crisis. And of course, the role has been somewhat ambivalent. China has been abstaining from making very clear points about supporting the West, but also hasn't been really directly supporting Russia or directly critiquing Russia for this war in Ukraine. So, but what the important thing about China's stance that I wanted to note here is that my read of Chinese media in Chinese language, as well as their English comments, they highlight that the key target of China's messaging is really the United States. We're talking here about the US and the context of our own democracy, but the messaging really aims at highlighting a degree of hypocrisy, right, of the U.S. Political system, but also the notion that it is U.S. and NATO that actually militarized Europe and have led to this crisis. So the key rhetoric here is to blame NATO, to blame the United States for essentially creating the right kind of fertile ground for Russia to proceed in this direction. And that message has stayed on point for the past 3.5 weeks. We're not seeing a huge shift in China's policy. So I think that's really quite a warning for us. How are we going to move forward? How will we relate to China? And as you said, bring China and Russia together to talk about climate change or any other global issues? Because at the moment, at least ideologically, in terms of rhetoric, China appears to echo more of Russia's sentiments and stance in global affairs. And also to use a lot of Russian footage, Russian statements in its own reporting of the war in Ukraine. I find that to be very interesting. And it's quite a shift from 2014, the takeover of Crimea, when China didn't quite express as strong of an anti-American stance at the time in relation to this war. So that's something that I think is a change in China's policy. At the same time, it's worth noting that China is unlikely to rescue Russia when it comes to this war. It's unlikely to rescue it militarily or economically. We're already seeing some Chinese banks breaking ties with Russia. We're seeing some exports of China's aircraft parts no longer going through to Russia and critique on the Russian side of those policies. So this relationship is maybe not quite as profound on this economic and strategic levels as it may appear, but ideologically, in terms of ideas and the quest to sort of balance out what they call the hegemony of the West. And of course, by the West, they mainly mean the United States, is very much tying these two countries together. So that's something that I wanted to leave you with in my brief opening remarks.
Right. And I should mention, Maria, that you speak both Chinese and Russian. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. All right. Let me open it up with a question, I think, on the minds of everybody. Simple question. Why did Putin invade Ukraine? What did he anticipate would happen? And what are the repercussions of what appears to be a failed military effort at this point?
I can jump in if you want. Okay. I think that, like, you know, Putin has been on a trajectory here, right? Where, you know, yes, he's been building this kind of kleptocratic autocratic system, but, you know, there was always this vein of nationalism that led to aggression. And we saw the invasion and occupation of two chunks of Georgia in 2008. We saw, when I was in government, the annexation of Crimea. He's been on a ramp where his autocracy at home was blending with this kind of nationalist aggression abroad. And Ukraine was always going to be the ultimate place where that ended. This is the largest population-wise former Soviet republic. It's the one that people like Putin feel have the deepest cultural and historical ties to Russia. But I also think, Senator, this gets to something you were saying at the beginning. I really worry about the fact that the circle around Putin has collapsed to basically one person. When I came into government in 2009, when Medvedev was president, Putin was still the shot caller as prime minister. There were these power blocks. There were oligarchs and there were security guys and there were military people. And there were, you know, even some liberals, not liberals in the perspective from the U.S., but, you know, in Putin's spectrum. By the end of the 8 years of Obama, that circle had shrunk to basically the security type guys. The intelligence services inner circle that Putin's had since he was deputy mayor of St. Petersburg and people, you know, from the FSB. And I think that shrinking of the circle as he was getting older and more accustomed to absolute power, right? You don't listen to dissenting views and that circle shrinks. And clearly what has happened even through COVID is that circle got smaller and smaller and smaller. Right. And so we're now dealing with an autocrat who's been basically in power for over 20 years, doesn't listen to dissenting views and has something of a bit of a messianic streak about his role in Russian history. It manifests itself in what is a very, you know, again, traditional in history, blood and soil endeavor. And again, I think part of what's so frightening about this war is how familiar it is. And Peter cited the invasion of Poland. I'm not one to overuse World War II analogies. You don't have to point to World War II, but just We should not become complacent that this kind of ideology, particularly when it's fueled by grievance, doesn't lead to war. It does. It always does. And that's why we have to be on guard against it here as well as there. I think his initial political objectives that he'd been oversold on by his own experience and by whoever he was left listening to, he thought that the overwhelming demonstration of force would lead to some rapid collapse or decapitation of the Ukrainian government. And he tried to repeat the play that he'd done on a much smaller scale in places like Crimea, Luhansk and Donetsk in Ukraine, or South Ossetia and Abkhazia in Georgia, which is you install some corrupt, you know, Putin crony who's a Ukrainian, but as your president, and you essentially kind of reestablish a Russian-dominated, demilitarized, corrupt satellite state in Ukraine. And when that failed, his political objectives of his military campaign were no longer attainable, because the Ukrainians are clearly not going to submit to such a government. Who would want to be the Ukrainian Russian-backed president of Ukraine? You're not going to last a second without Russian occupying forces there. And I think, tragically, what we're watching is he's therefore, in the absence of being able to achieve his political objectives militarily, he's decimating and leveling cities. He's doing what he did in Grozny in Chechnya to Mariupol now, and tragically will likely be other cities, both because that's all he can accomplish militarily, and also because perhaps, and this is why Mariupol is the focus, if he can connect some big chunk of Ukrainian territory in the south and east, then as he negotiates a quote-unquote peace deal, he has some territory to bring into that negotiation. So that's where I see things.
Yeah. Okay. Brian, let me just uh-huh. add, and I agree with Ben, but just I always remind my constituents and others who talk about this in terms of the whys, I always remind that Putin was head of the KGB. I mean, and so he comes in operating like that. And this is his last stance, I think. And I think he sees this as do or die. And that's why it's so dangerous, because like you said, you know, he's a one man show right now. And he's backed in a corner. And I worry because of that if we don't get somehow these negotiations, some kind of peace negotiations or de-escalation agreements, that who knows what's next. And so the future, I think, is very dire if we can't get some kind of semblance of ceasefire very quickly, because his back is backed into a corner now. And with that KGB modus operandi and mentality, you know, this is his last hurrah.
Peter, Maria, you want to jump in on that?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, well, I just wanted to echo the point on the messianic kind of sentiment that Putin is exuding. I think it's a large ideological mission that he's kind of conveying here. And watching his speeches in Russian, this hour-long, incredibly long speeches, and some described them as dull and boring, I actually thought they were quite engaging and quite, you know, well put together in terms of his larger mission is to create this larger Russo world, this Ruskii Mir, the larger kind of sphere of influence. And without achieving something, without gaining some kind of peace or something to showcase some victory, he's not going to give up. It's just because it's going to make him look completely incompetent. And just to bring up this idea also of external legitimation, that's something that Ben mentioned, that post-2014, for instance, the public opinion rankings have gone up in Russia in favor of Putin after the annexation of Crimea. It was a relatively easy win, right? And there wasn't as much suffering. So his rankings have gone up, but maybe he was expecting something similar to happen in this case. But nowadays, of course, ordinary Russians are going to suffer. There's already huge queues for sugar in some places. People are discussing ways to immigrate and leave the country. So it's becoming more and more dire for ordinary people. Is this going to affect his ratings? And how is he going to come off with winning nothing? He has to showcase some kind of a new program or a new image of Russia, right, to this domestic constituency. What was it worth fighting for? Why are we fighting for this, right? And of course, Ukrainians and Russians are so close culturally as well. It's worth noting that many Russians have family members in Ukraine and vice versa. So there's a lot of connections, right? There's a lot of cultural and familial ties. So killing one another is a particularly tragic reality to watch for people in Russia and in Ukraine. So it's an incredibly divisive war where some members of families don't even no longer speak to each other. So, but going back to Putin, I do think that it's impossible to expect that he's going to just readily give up with nothing. He's really awaiting something that could secure his legacy. And that legacy from the beginning was quite grand. It's the creation of a new Russian world with Putin at the helm of it.
If I could just pick up, I think that the irony here is that Putin wants a sphere of influence. That's not unique to him. The United States also wants a sphere of influence. China wants a sphere of influence. Every great power wants a sphere of influence. Putin's problem is that the United States has some capacity to have a sphere of influence based on what's called soft power, on its appeal, the fact that trading with the United States can make you wealthier, the fact that America's domestic model has some appeal. Even China, although they're domestic, although they're brutally totalitarian, at least trading with them can bring wealth, you know, because they're an economic powerhouse. Putin's wants Ukraine desperately to be within Russia's sphere of influence, at the heart of Russia's sphere of influence. But he has nothing really to appeal to the Ukrainians with, except for blunt force. And so the problem is, we've seen this again and again over the last 15 years in Ukraine. The Ukrainians want to move towards the West. because they don't want a corrupt government like Russia's. They want to be prosperous. They want to be democratic. And the only way that Putin can try to keep them in his orbit is through blunt force, which has exactly the opposite effect, makes them even more desperately want to get out of his orbit such that they're willing to fight him for it.
All right, let me jump in with, again, consistent with a lot of the questions that came in tonight. Nobody in their right minds wants a nuclear war. Nobody wants World War III. All of us are horrified by the barbarity of what the Russians are doing, just leveling cities, killing civilians. In the midst of all of that, not wanting a world war, but wanting to do something to end this brutality, what is the proper role of the United States government at this moment? How is President Biden doing?
Well, Bernie, I think, first of all, I think President Biden has calibrated this in the proper way. And as a progressive who, opposed the authorization to use force, who really tries to see all options before the military option being executed, I think even with the security and military assistance, I think he is doing the right thing. We've got to help. And Peter, I'm glad you talked about the support for security assistance for the Ukrainian people, because we've got to do that. And we've got to help them defend themselves, short of putting our troops in harm's way, short of inserting ourselves in the middle of a war that could lead to a third world war. Secondly, I think what also is very important to recognize is the Biden administration for months orchestrated a diplomatic channel, a diplomatic approach. I mean, their diplomacy, bar none, I think, was pretty significant and robust. And they engaged in every form of diplomacy, I think, that they could. And so I think as one who is very careful about any military operation, I think that they've done everything they can do and continue to do to help find a pathway to peace. And also in terms of just supporting refugees, I mean, we have to remember we're up to 3 million plus refugees now. Yeah. And this is a crime against humanity, what's taking place. And so they have put resources in. Just in my budget alone, it's over $6 billion. But we need more to provide. And we have to make sure that we open our doors to refugees and that we support, all of the efforts to with other countries that they are providing the refuge that these individuals, these people need. And so I think that, and also I believe the Biden administration has done a really good job in unifying the European allies. I mean, Donald Trump, really formed a schism and a divide and conquer kind of policy. And I think, unfortunately, because of Ukraine, I see more unity now with our European allies. And I think that's a good thing, Bernie.
Okay, what I wanted to do now is ask that same question to Peter, Ben, and Maria, but I also wanted to pick up on a point that Barbara just made. We're seeing, at least in recent history, unprecedented unity among the United States and our European allies. How do we build on that other than in a military sense? Is there some silver lining in the midst of all of this horror that we're witnessing now?
I think so. And what I look at is, look in the short term, I think, supporting Ukraine and avoiding the direct military confrontation and supporting the Ukrainians in whatever peace deal they want to make. Sometimes the United States becomes more maximalist than the party at the table here. So I think it's very important in the nearer term that the Ukrainians are empowered to be the ones making peace. But to your question, I think it's really important, and it ties to the democracy aspect. There's a lot of enthusiasm now to deal with some of these structural issues. I'll name just a few, right? We talked about kleptocracy. Well, we sanctioned a bunch of oligarchs. The sanctions aren't worth anything if the oligarchs can set up front companies under different names in places like the British Virgin Islands, or where, serviced by lobbyists in Washington and law firms and PR shops that do reputation laundering in London. We have to look whole. If we really want to get rid of the kind of oligarch, it's not going to end the war in Ukraine, but it is essential to ending the Putinism that led to the war in Ukraine. if we can go deeper with the Europeans in attacking all the different dimensions of this, not just sanctions and sanctions enforcement, but illicit and invisible finance, that would be, go a long way to getting rid of a big chunk of corruption. You talk about public corruption. There are things that the US and Europe both have to do to get rid of foreign money in our politics. In Europe, it's actually a much bigger problem where the Russians are literally just financing the far right in Europe. They're doing it surreptitiously here in the United States to some extent too. But I think there is an agenda to be looked at across the board at the degrees to which, because part of what's been done is he's coordinated an international far right, an international ethno-nationalist collection of creeps and goons. And so I think looking at national laws and international collaborative approaches to kind of excising not just kind of Russian influence, but foreign influence, dark money, and this kind of nascent, or not even that nascent anymore, emergence of a global of far-right nationalism that is threatening us from within, I think has to be a piece of that. Disinformation ties into that. You know, we handed Putin, with our own social media platforms completely unregulated, a megaphone that he could never reach. Peter's right. There's not a lot of soft power emanating from a kleptocratic cult of personality around a former KGB agent. What there is, though, is the capacity to spread infinite amounts of information for free on American-made platforms that are literally an open door to the toxicity that has been like just mainlined into our democracy. So I think,
let me jump in and pick up on a point that you make, which is a huge point for this war, for Russia, for the United States, for the whole world. And that is the issue of disinformation. In America right now, you have tens of millions of people who believe that Mr. Trump won the election and it was stolen from him. Tens of millions of people believe that. And we have Mr. Putin telling the people of Russia that they were forced into this war to protect the people of Ukraine against Nazis, right? On a global scale, with the internet and everything else, what does one do about this incredible level of disinformation? And Maria, you correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I'm hearing from you is actually his disinformation campaign in Russia is working, at least. People believe what he's saying. Is that correct?
Well, it's very hard to poll Russians about what they actually believe in because, again, it's an autocratic environment, so it's very hard to trust the polls. But some recent polls showcased about 60% support for the war. But, you know, having watched a lot of these propaganda messages, it is quite, you know, sophisticated in terms of its production quality. And so much of the stories are exactly the same, but the actual framing is completely upside down, right? Who is guilty here? Why is this war taking place? What are the interests of Russia? It's framed as an existential threat for Russia. It's not just a war. It's an existential threat to the survival of Russia in its current form, of its territorial borders, you know, being secured, and of the future of Russian people. So the way they frame the story is completely opposite of anything you would see on Western media. And it is being broadcasted every single day, many hours a day to ordinary Russians. Of course, younger people might not be watching TV as much, but the social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter have been banned. So it's very hard to get alternative information at the moment in Russia.
Peter, word on disinformation.
Yeah, I wanted to just it's connected to this, but I in terms of the rebuilding of what we can use this moment for, you know, there's a word that you very rarely hear from American politicians, including this president, unfortunately, and the word is international law. One of the reasons one of the things that made it easier for Putin to do this was that some of the core restraints that had been built into the international system after 1945, above all, that you don't wage war, you don't invade your neighbors and try to change borders by force, that norm had been weakened, and we played a role in weakening it. And it seems to me that part of the opportunity we have now, because the world is so revolted by what Putin has done, is to try to rebuild those norms. But we can't do it only by talking about how horrific he is. We also have to be willing to look in the mirror. That's what's much, much rarer. Just a few examples. We're now talking about wanting to call Putin a war criminal. Good, he is a war criminal. We're not members of the International Criminal Court. Right? Why aren't we members of the International Criminal Court? Because we were afraid that it might launch a prosecution against us for what we did in Afghanistan or what Israel has been doing. We can't have it both ways, right? If you want strong institutions that can bring Putin to heel, we have to help make them strong. The Trump administration recognized Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights and Morocco's annexation of Western Sahara. These were actions by force that then annexed parts of other territories in clear violation of international law. The Russians noticed that. They use that all the time to justify their, what they did in Crimea. If we want to say that that's wrong, which Putin did, it absolutely is, we have to clean up our own house. And that's the kind of discourse that progressives have to bring to the table, because hawks and the foreign policy establishment, what Ben famously called the blob, are not going to do that kind of introspection. They're always going to fall into the trap of thinking that the only people who violate these principles our adversaries.
I just add disinformation, and totally agree with everything Peter said. You know, like there's been these kind of different conversations in Europe and in states in the United States, and then in Congress about regulation of social media platforms related to disinformation. And I think this is a real opportunity. You know, one of the things that the Biden administration's done well is just basically been transparent about the disinformation campaigns. And we've seen the value of informing people. When you get to introducing responsibility and potential liability to tech companies for the dissemination of hate speech, incitement, and conspiracy theory on their platforms, you know, there are many different ways of approaching that, right? Whether you're looking at whether you're introducing regulations around the algorithms that spread the more sensationalist content, or whether or not you're introducing more responsibility for content moderation. I think the baseline, bottom line, whether you're a technologist or just a user, is that this is dangerous. Like we're witnessing the first war that was basically built entirely on disinformation. I mean, well, there have been previous wars, but with the technologies that are currently available, it's basically like if you took some of the same disinformation that you saw in the 30s in Germany and made them available on a variety of multimedia platforms. I think that this compels us getting a common position. If the United States and Europe literally just articulated the principles about what the expectations should be on tech companies around this disinformation issue, just that, I think, would have a significant galvanizing impact, even without, in the absence of legislation here. So I think this is a time to bring together these different conversations around privacy and disinformation that have been happening in Europe and in state houses and to some extent in Congress. Because even if you can't get legislation through the United States Congress, if there's a clear articulation of what the objectives are from national governments or even state level governments in this country, I think you'll see the tech companies trying to begin to get there to some extent themselves, even if it's not as far as all of us might like.
Can I just add one point on disinformation? Just, yes. You know, one aspect of it is regulation, but the other aspect is education, right? More training and media literacy, more funding in professional public journalism. I mean, there's so many different facets to battling disinformation. A lot of this work is already being carried out, but it's often underfunded. So I think it's also about funding these initiatives and collaborating more with European partners, but also with civil society actors. There's a lot of movement in that direction.
Yeah, on disinformation, I think we have to sound the alarm with these elections coming up, Bernie. I mean, you know, I think there's, we know the history of misinformation, disinformation in our own country from prior elections. And so right now is the time we need to crack down, quite frankly, on these campaigns of disinformation, because it's taking place right now in our own country.
Right.
As you know, and part of the problem with, I think, the media tends to bifurcate these foreign policy and domestic policy debates, right? So you can be a Republican member of Congress who's spreading disinformation about January 6th and undermining our democracy, and get on and do an interview in which you wax eloquent about all of the disinformation and anti-democratic stuff that Putin's doing. And it's way too rare for people to turn around and say, what about what you're doing here? Those conversations need to be integrated together. And I think too often in the media, they're not.
I want to get back to this issue of oligarchy and kleptocracy. In the American media, speaking of media, when you hear the word oligarchy, it's always preceded by Russian oligarchy. Well, I don't want to break the bad news to everybody, but we got an oligarchy in this country too. You know, when you got two people owning more wealth than the bottom 40%, and when you have, during this terrible pandemic, million people dead, these billionaires getting richer than ever before, raising prices on their products, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not just the Russian issue. It's not just an American issue. It exists, of course, all over the Gulf states. We got these people worth zillions and zillions of dollars, often petrodollars, right? So let's talk about oligarchy. Let's talk about fossil fuel. Let's talk about climate and its progressives, where we have to move. Barbara, you want to take a shot at that?
Well, when you talk about our reliance on fossil fuels, now's the time. to really recognize that our reliance on fossil fuels puts money directly into the pockets of the war machine and of Putin. And now is the moment to really look at our laws and look at all of the financial transactions and that allow oligarchs to actually rob their people and hide their stolen assets in this country and other countries. And now is the time, I think, and yes, you know, the price of gasoline is hurting and so many families, but now's the time to use this moment, I think, to really begin to transition off of fossil fuels into green energy. And now's the time to educate the public while we have this moment where it's very clear that this reliance on fossil fuels in many ways creates wars, but also creates a planet that is in the state of emergency.
So what you're saying is that fossil fuel is not only a climate issue, it's a national security issue.
It's the national security issue. Absolutely.
All right. Who wants to jump in?
I jump in and say, look at the, you mentioned the Gulf, Senator. I totally agree. One area was a little disappointing. The administration is not telling more of a story around why this should be an impetus for transitioning away from fossil fuels, rather than trying to make up the difference with additional production from these types of countries. Are we surprised that Mohammed bin Salman is not riding to the rescue to the Ukrainian people and the American paying at the pump? Why would we be shocked that this guy's not taking our calls? He benefits from precisely the kind of system that Putin sits on top of, which is a one man, one rule, multi-trillion dollar pyramid scheme that is tied entirely to stuff that comes from the ground that they had nothing to do with themselves, right? And so I think this is a time for us to get more consistent and not outsource a degree of our foreign policy to the Emirates, where all the oligarchs will be stashing their money because it's a real hub for illicit finance and money laundering, and to the Saudis, who benefit from a national security policy that creates dependency on them to have leverage on us on everything from whether or not we're engaged in a war in Yemen to whether or not we're looking the other way when they chop up journalists because they have oil. So I think connecting the oligarchy discussion, absolutely the need to go after that infrastructure, to the transition to clean energy is both the way to provide a guarantee that we're not going hat in hand to a collection of autocrats to increase production every time we have a problem at the pump, but also to kind of end this dependence that has sacrificed the moral high ground for the United States and has given way too much of a sense of impunity to everybody from Vladimir Putin to Mohammed bin Salman to Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, right? So I think, you know, this is the missing piece that progressives, I think, really need to push this administration on.
Thoughts on kleptocracy, oligarchy? All right. We're coming to the end. You guys want to say a few words and summarize your feelings about where we are at the moment? Peter, why don't you begin?
I think the enormous challenge we have is to recognize that in the short term, the Ukrainian people need our support. And we need to try to strengthen them in this heroic fight that they're engaged in so their nations can survive. And ultimately, there can be a peace that allows them to survive as a nation against this horrific criminal imperialist assault. But the danger that we have to recognize is that as heroic and necessary as this is, there are a lot of forces in American foreign policy and in Washington that are going to use this to try to create a permanent Cold War with both Russia and China. And I'm not saying we're going to have good relationships with Vladimir Putin tomorrow, nor should we. But it's incumbent on progressives to remind people of the dangers of Cold War, the way in which the last Cold War led to horrific suffering in proxy wars around the world, the way in which another Cold War will mean that it's impossible to rein in defense spending, as Representative Lee has been doing, the way in which another Cold War is going to make it much harder to deal with this existential threat of climate. After all, what's the biggest institution? What institution uses more fossil fuels than any other in the planet? It's the American military. So our challenge is to support the Ukrainians in this moment, but also make sure that this moment and their heroism doesn't get used to move the United States down a path that's ultimately going to be bad for progressive ideals in a lot of ways.
You know, I agree with you. I would just add to this, I've been to a number of classified meetings to the Senate. I'm sure Barbara has in the House. And I got to say that for some of my colleagues, what's going on now is almost brings forth a sigh of relief. You don't have to talk about ending childhood poverty. You don't have to talk about transforming our energy system. You don't have to talk about taxing billionaires or dealing with childcare or education or creating universal health care. You don't have to talk about that anymore because we can go back to the good old Cold War. We have people to hate. We can spend more money on the military. And after all, that's what we're supposed to be doing. And I worry about that very much. So you everything you said was right, but it also, if we fall into this trap, it will radically change our priorities. We'll start ignoring the needs of working families. Why don't we go to Maria?
Sure. So following up on this point in terms of the Cold War or striking this fire of Cold War, I did want to highlight that I think this rhetoric of the Cold War is also very popular. Or it instigates quite a strong response from countries like China that end up using it to push back and to extend their own sphere of influence. And I think the biggest, you know, way of protecting and shielding our democracy, but also of becoming a more powerful symbol of democracy globally, is, of course, rebuilding our own democratic system. And I think that's something that China, Chinese public is paying very close attention to. And we see that the biggest critique that comes up in Chinese media is about the failures of our own democracy. They're using January 6th events as an insurrection as a way to criticize our own domestic failures. They're talking about the rule of capital, right, over society, the idea that we are an oligarchy in some ways. And they're pushing back and against the fact that we are a more moral kind of democracy than theirs. So I think that by building our own, you know, internal political system, that's why elections coming up are so important. It's not just a domestic issue. It's really an issue that is very important for our foreign policy. I'm a strong believer of that. And I think that is the way to shield, to protect, but also to unify, you know, at this kind of initial cause when it comes to US and Europe, to kind of bring forth this movement and to push back against this larger cloud of autocracy.
Thank you. Ben? Ben,
I just end by saying, you know, there really is like a question of democracy versus autocracy that's the heart of this. And I recognize, as Peter alluded to at the beginning, like sometimes it makes progressives a little uncomfortable given America's history of promoting democracy abroad is so fraught, particularly in recent years.
Overthrowing
democracies, yeah. So, but the issue is, you know, what I was alluding to earlier is like when I really wrestled with Putin, you know, towards the end of the Obama administration after, I realized that part of what he was doing is, if you really hated somebody, what would you try to do? You try to turn them into the worst version of themselves, right? Putin was constantly responding to, reacting to, sparring with like the worst version of America that he could project onto us. And the reality is this is an existential threat to democracy, what we're seeing in Ukraine, but we can't deal with it unless there are progressive solutions that are part of it. You know, the correlator, what Peter said is if this becomes the Cold War and it's just something that the hawks and others can fight, they're actually going to get it wrong too, because ultimately, far more than any foreign policy, it would have been better if the last 30 years we were transitioning to clean energy and we were fortifying our societies against kleptocracy and we were building technology platforms that were regulated for public safety and health purposes, right? And so I think going forward, part of what we can bring to this is the extent to which progressive solutions are absolutely essential to the survivability of democracy. And that it's not a foreign domestic issue to say that you can't beat kleptocracy without excising it at home, or saying we can't beat Russian disinformation if we're going to have the floodgates open for disinformation everywhere else in the world. And on issue after issue, and the energy issue that you pointed to too, like that the surest way to reduce the malignant power of oil-rich oligarchs is to no longer create oil-rich oligarchs, right? And oh, by the way, we can save the planet in the process. So we have to have the confidence to come forward and connect progressive ideas, many of which start at home, to the success abroad. And by the way, I'd end by saying solidarity with the Ukrainian people obviously is a priority right now, but solidarity globally with activists who are fighting these fights. And by the way, a lot of Russians who have fled the country, right? Like, we need to be talking to those people, because if there becomes a time where Putin collapses, the whole thing comes crashing down, right? Who is going to be there to step back in? We need to be building ties across, like just the way the far right has, across activism that encompasses some of the Russians who've self-emigrated here.
Yeah, you mentioned the activists in Russia, and I think it's important that we do say a word about the incredible courage that we have seen from thousands and thousands of people who protested the war out on the streets. They knew the repercussions of that. They've been arrested. God knows what happens to them. So within Russia, we know there is a significant, don't know exactly how much, amount of dissent. And I really applaud the courage of those people literally putting their lives on the line.
That was a recent panel discussion on Ukraine, convened by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. We'll keep following the Ukraine story as it unfolds. There have been various negotiations between Russian and Ukrainian governments, and those appear to be ongoing as well. And we'll report back to you here on Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time in your community radio stations, WCRS LP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRN LP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll be with you again next week.